It's Thursday. I'm Gab. He's Jules. It's overcast in London. What else is new? It's International Week. We're going to get into all those games. France's draw. Holland stinker. But we're going to start at the top because we have a guest
Special
today.
Guest. Yeah.
Special guest.
Yeah.
Yes. It's Kia Jurabshan. You should know who he is. But Kia, thanks for joining us. To make it clear, can you tell us what you do?
Hi. Thanks, Gabby. Our sports management company now, over the last few years, has grown quite substantially. We manage mostly, we are now very concentrated in football and soccer for the American viewers. And I guess, you know, we now have offices across the world. We are in 7 countries at the moment. Our group has grown quite substantially over the last 10 years. So essentially, you know, we take care of, you know, the football and soccer stars, and we are looking at, you know, more expansion towards other sports.
One big thing when it comes to the game and transfers, we've had Andrea Agnelli, the president of the European Clubs Association, talk about how in these 2 years, they expect to make losses of between 6 and 8 billion euros in revenue. There's a lot of doom and gloom. There's a lot of people who kind of predict that this summer, 2020, is going to be a pretty slow summer, simply because a lot of clubs are strapped for cash and maybe they're hesitant to take chances. Is that how you see the general climate? Is that the feedback you're getting?
Well, I think like everything around the world, everything has been affected because of the COVID pandemic and this awful year of 2020 that we had due to this pandemic. And we're still seeing some reminiscence across Europe of that. With last week, you know, Italy and France shutting down again, going back into a lockdown, and other countries are going in and out of lockdown. The US and UK seem to be on the right path of vaccinations. And I think one of the good indicating signs was that the US opened up, you know, fans for NBA and for other events, be it just 2,000 people. Super Bowl had fans. And I think once we start getting the fans back in the stadiums, the football clubs will start to see some light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that that's the key, really, because we've lost a lot of revenue in the industry and a lot of, you know, excitement and entertainment and a lot of, you know, interaction between players and fans. So overall, it is the January window that passed looked quite gloomy. I'm a bit more positive about the summer because I think we're heading towards the right strategy. I think with everyone getting back into the stadiums, with the vaccination rolls going out well in the UK, that will help. But of course, the football market is global and we all need a strong global market. China has changed its direction. And so that is going to have some effects for sure. Other parts of the world, if they can get themselves out of lockdown, if Italy and Spain and Germany and can get themselves out of the lockdown situation, allow fans back in, that will definitely help the European market.
Kia, I guess usually at this time of the year, your phone never stops ringing. Clubs are preparing for the summer, the recruitment for next season, etc. Do you have a sense already that with you and your team that maybe it's a bit more quieter, or there's still the same activity and maybe it's just the amount of the transfers, for example, that'd be lower than usual?
See, I think the one thing that maybe occurred during COVID is that there was a price fit. You know, prices started to correct themselves a little bit. Numbers were getting quite out of control. And no matter whether you had COVID or not, it was becoming very difficult for clubs to sustain themselves, as you have seen in the case of Barcelona, when you are paying $200 million or 200 million euros or 200 million pounds for every single player, or they're costing you something around 100 to 200. And that became very unsustainable for even the smaller clubs pre-COVID, because what would happen is if you have one player that gets sold for 180 and he may be able to go to Barcelona, but then the problem occurs is that the smaller deals became also bigger. So, you know, the 40 millions became 80s and the 30 millions became 60s and the 5 millions became 20. So everything started to lose its balance, and it was getting very difficult for the market. Of course, with the effect of COVID, it became even more difficult. And I think what will happen is you'll see activity, you'll see transfers, but you'll see it coming back maybe to kind of prices around 2015, 16 years, where it was a little bit more, you know, an 80 million deal would be unheard of, but a 60 million deal would be huge. You will always have clubs, individual clubs who are very wealthy, who will pay the asking price and the demands for certain players because that's what they want, and they will do that. But that's not talking about the general football market, because when we talk about the general football market, we don't talk about just the top end of the Premier League. You have to talk about all the divisions across England, Europe, and the rest of the world. MLS is now paying for, you know, there was a foreign transfer recently for an MLS team for over $12 million. That is quite a big number for MLS, and that's, you know, moving in the in a direction that is positive. And I think, you know, once you start to have a little bit of movement from other global countries that have not normally been there, the market will stabilize and will be a, you know, will be good.
So you talked about how the market was due for a correction anyway. I want to get your views on financial fair play, because UEFA made the point that as difficult as the situation is now in terms of cash flow and whatnot for clubs, it would have been a lot worse if financial fair play hadn't existed since 2013. So it's a two-part question. Do you agree with that? And secondly, they're going to reform financial fair play soon. There's a meeting on Friday. What direction do you think would be the right direction for financial fair play or financial regulation?
See, I think financial fair play going back, you know, to 2013 has been a little bit unfair on smaller clubs in any case. It's, you know, my personal opinion, and I'll explain. Financial fair play model is based on your income, your revenue, and how much you can therefore spend based on the amount of money that you've got coming in. Of course, a club like Manchester United, who has, you know, a stadium with, you know, 80,000 people, with the kind of numbers that they're, you know, can attract across the world in sponsorships, etc. And then you have a club, for example, like Burnley or an Everton or a Southampton or something like that, that maybe the owners have the wealth to back them and are willing to back them, but they're restricted because that particular club doesn't have the revenue stream. So how do you ever start to compete at the top if you, one, cannot inject your own capital in order to compete, and your revenue stream is low? Increase your revenue stream. How do you increase your revenue stream? You get more fans. How do you get more fans? You have to have a winning team. So in order to do that, you have to have a winning team. And financial fair play and that kind of structure where you have a financial control in the States works, because there's no transfer of players in NBA and in NFL, and the teams get the best of the next crop that is coming through, and each year it's a different team that gets the next of the best crop of players coming through. In football, we don't have that. So if you can afford to buy, let's say, you know, Riyad Mahrez, but your financial fair play doesn't allow you to buy Riyad Mahrez. So therefore, who ends up buying Riyad Mahrez? Manchester City. Because you can't spend $60 million to buy Riyad Mahrez, and so Manchester City can, and they end up with it, and they just get stronger and stronger and stronger because they have all this foreign income and revenue through their sponsorships. And clubs like, you know, Everton's and Southampton's and even the likes of Arsenal and Tottenham, unless they start to build that model, you know, they won't be able to compete.
So one of the reasons, I mean, I take your point there. One of the reasons is that in the past, we've had rich people coming in. They sign contracts. They take on expenses trying to pursue that. And then something goes wrong and they pull out and the system collapses. So to avoid that, one of the solutions that they're looking at, which exists in some American sports, maybe for different reasons, is something like a luxury tax. So you say, okay, wealthy owner comes into Everton or Manchester City. You want to spend more than a certain amount. That's fine. But you have to then, for every pound you go over the limit, you have to put a pound into some sort of central pot, be it for redistribution, be it for emergency bailouts, whatever. Could that be a good compromise to in terms of maintaining the solidity of the system while still allowing those who can to invest?
Oh, I understand that concept. That concept doesn't work because you have transfers. So you are actually paying a transfer fee. See, that concept works in the States because you don't have any transfer fees. And, you know, you will then, if you want to hire, let's say, LeBron James and your salary cap goes over, you know, you are paying into a pot based on the salary cap situation that is going over, rather than if you then had to go out and purchase a player for 40 or 50 million, that player didn't end up working out for your club. And you then have to pay money into a pot as well. You know, that becomes a pretty big hit. And soon owners would shy away from something like that. I think the issue of financial fair play and what you were saying about people overextending themselves, there should be a financial control. So if you then want to invest, let's say, 100 million into Southampton or Leicester or Everton or somewhere that doesn't have the same income stream as the bigger guys, then you should have to give some sort of a guarantee that, okay, there's the 100 million. And if I then walk away and leave the club, that particular deal is covered. So the club will then become sustainable on its own, and you wouldn't have that, because if you are making that deal, then you are paying, you know, let's say you're spending 20 million to purchase a player. You have, you know, 10 million in salaries over 4 years, as an example. That 30 million is covered by the guarantee that has been given. Could be a bank guarantee, could be an upfront cash payment, or a manner of that to protect the club. You have a much bigger problem in the Championship, because in the Championship, you know, ironically, it's supposed to be, you know, very fair and very balanced, but if you do have money in the Championship, you're completely restricted from spending it. And the clubs that go from the Premier League down, they're the ones who are getting the big parachute payments to come straight back up. So if you are a smaller club in the Championship, you know, and you have to abide by the Championship financial fair play rule, you've got no chance against the three that are coming down, because those three have got massive parachute payments. You have to be so much smarter. You have 46 games to play. And no matter how smart you are and how you balance that, it's a very, very difficult task. As you can see, Norwich and Watford are first and second in the league. Why? Because, you know, they have come down with Premier League players. They have sold very little of those players. And, you know, it becomes very difficult for the rest of the Championship to compete. And each year is the same. Of course, you always get the one team that then collapses because of error in management or error in decision that comes down from the championship and fithers away, or lack of financing that the club just doesn't want to finance it anymore because it's collapsed. But generally, it doesn't work. And it's extremely unfair.
Could you see a salary cap being introduced in football? Or do you think, one, it would be a bad idea, and two, it's actually impossible to do considering the structure of the game here that we have compared to what we see in US sports, for example?
I mean, if you bring in a salary cap, you have to bring it in to the sport globally, or at least, you know, in the sense that all of Europe plus England has to do that. You know, everybody has to obey by it, because if you had a salary cap, for example, in England, and you didn't have it in Italy, then you'd get an imbalance because players would start shifting over to Italy. You know, when you have salary caps in countries like, you know, the US and the NBA or in the NFL, that market is predominantly US. So you don't get much competition from a European club to compete in the NBA or from a European club to compete in the NFL. But for us in football and soccer, we have basically globally competition across the world. So we had competition from China, we have competition from Japan, we have competition from the US, the Middle East, South America. And if you're going to put in a salary cap, you have to put in a salary cap that abides for everybody.
You may be one of the most global people in your line of work, in the sense that, you know, you've done business and big business in China. You were involved directly with a club in Brazil, in North America. I want to ask, because every so often you hear talk of a European Super League breaking away, the big clubs handling their own money. And I always feel like it's a threat so that bigger clubs can get a better deal from UEFA from the Champions League. And it sounds like they are going to get a better deal for themselves. But would the idea of a Super League in another continent, for example, in North America, where they're talking about, there's talk of merging MLS and Liga MX, or in Africa, where Gianni Infantino has suggested it, or maybe in Asia, might that help the sport grow commercially in those countries too? So that maybe rich people from those countries invest locally rather than investing in Europe and necessarily the whole world following the European model.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I think you have a very good point there. I think European-wise and Super League in terms of Europe and England and this sort of, you know, region, would be terrible for the overall sport of the smaller clubs. You know, if you imagine, for example, a club in the Championship coming into the Premier League, but, you know, can't get into this Super League because, you know, they've just fought to get into the Premier League, and the Premier League money will then start to shrink, and the Premier League will start to wither away because everyone wants to watch the Super League. At the moment, I think, you know, the Champions League is one of the best competitions, and we all get very excited when we have to see cross, you know, country clubs playing. When you have a Bayern Munich and a Real Madrid, or a Bayern Munich and a Man City, or a Man United against a Barcelona, this is a great excitement. But it's limited because on Saturday we go back to the basics, and those clubs are playing the likes of Burnley, Sheffield Wednesday, etc. And I think, Sheffield United, I should have said. I'll be killed in Yorkshire for that. But you know, in that sense, I think, you know, it's very important because we have to help. Sports is supposed to be enjoyed by everyone, and every club should technically be able to compete. And it's no fun to support a team that you know is not going to have any chance to compete for the next 10 or 15 years. And I think that that's a model that we have to resolve by creating these super leagues and breakout leagues sure, you know, the top 10, 20 clubs in the world will get bigger and they'll dominate that sport. But then it will, you know, take away the home roots of essentially what the game is about. Because essentially, if you're from Newcastle, you support Newcastle or Sunderland. Essentially, if you're from London, you will support your local London team, or Manchester, you would support your local Manchester team. But if your team has no chance of getting into this great Super League, and this Super League is dominating and it's the wealth and all the best players are there, everyone will want to watch them, and you'll start to have a bad effect, I think, on the smaller clubs. And I use bad examples there. I'm not even talking about the clubs like Newcastle or et cetera. I'm talking even about smaller clubs like Rotherham's Swansea, for example, or something like that.
But I take your point about that, and that has been part of the history and the culture of the way the sport has grown, certainly in Europe and in South America. You know, you have strong local roots, you have divisions, you have promotion, relegation. I'm just wondering, in other parts of the world, like in Asia or in North America, that's not the case. You have closed systems. There's just a different model. Do you think that? So I just want to get your take on that. I mean, do you think that applies to them too? Because
yeah, I mean, you linked, for example, a league where you had Argentina, Brazil, let's say, you know, Uruguay, Chile, Colombia, etc., all in one super league, and you had those teams playing each other, you know, on a weekend basis. You know, that would be a tough task in South America. I spent a lot of time in South America. You know that. You know, you're gonna get a lot of fighting there. But I think, you know, essentially, it becomes very difficult because the MLS is on a completely separate system. Mexico is on a different system. So linking, for example, the MLS with Canada, Mexico, et cetera, would be technically a good idea, because, you know, you would get one incredible sort of, you know, North American league. But unfortunately, because of the way that they're structured, the systems that are structured, at the moment, the MLS is very successful. Franchise values are going up and up and up. And they're getting more and more fans. So for them to break away, or certain teams to break away, I think becomes very complicated. And I think it becomes politically very difficult. Even in China and Japan and Korea, you know, you have a whole different, political climate around that. So that's going to be difficult to maintain as well.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. I just want to ask you about doing your job. I mean, Jules and I travel, and we see people in your line of work at matches, in hotels, around the world continuously. All of that ended for us as it did for you. Can you talk a little bit how challenging it's been, both in terms of doing deals and also looking after the players after the players you manage, when you can't travel, when you have to talk to these guys on Zoom or FaceTime?
Well, I guess the most challenging part of it has been when, you know, there is a issue or a crisis or an injury or something where normally, you know, from my standpoint, and especially the people that work with me in our company, if we had an injury, let's say, of a player in Spain, or we had an injury of a player in Italy, we'd like to be there. We'd like to, you know, give that player support. We'd like to understand what's happened. We'd like to be part of the decision-making of how the treatment should, you know, be. And I'm not talking about a club injury or a hamstring or something, but a more serious injury, like someone has to have a knee operation or an ankle operation or a shoulder operation. And those things sometimes become quite overwhelming for a player who has not been through that experience before. And that's something that, you know, we could always give them that extra bit of support, you know, explain to them the differences of how you would do this surgery or the recuperation period, you know, and be able to communicate better with the club doctors, because when you're there and you're physically there and you're talking to the club and you're talking to the club doctors and the player is there, it's a whole different atmosphere than when you're across a computer screen, such as Zoom. On the other aspect of it, in terms of the deals and getting the business actually flowing, you know, that becomes a different story, because most of the times we're always on the phone or on a, you know, we used to be on a FaceTime at some point, but now we're on a Zoom at some, you know, so it's just the name of the app has changed, as opposed to, you know, the actual onset. But we spend a lot of time on the phone talking, and that hasn't changed, and that's actually increased. You know, my days are now sort of never ending, which I'm, you know, and I love what I do, so I don't mind, but, you know, that's what they are, right? Because, and the biggest concern for me is also, with all of this has happened, is, you know, mental health issues. And I think it's a very serious topic, and I think, you know, people don't really put enough emphasis into it. But so many people expect that sports people or people that they think are in a more, privileged position because of their job, in terms of finances, you know, should not occur things. But I think the one thing that we've noticed is everyone is going through quite a heavy, different scales, but quite a heavy mental strain over the COVID. And that is something that there's no value of what your earning is or what you do for a living or what happens that can actually affect that. And that, I'm a bit worried about that side of things. But for me personally, in terms of, you know, the travel, I would like to see the guys. I would like to, you know, have that one-to-one contact. I would like to be a part of, you know, the job that we do best. It's a little bit more challenging over a computer, but, you know, at the moment, everyone understands. So we're doing the best we can.
Kia, what do you prefer doing? Is it dealing with the players that you advise and look after? Is it working with clubs? Is it advising people? What is the thing that you like the most in your job?
You know, I think I like all aspects of the job. I like the one-to-one contact with my players. You know, most of our guys are very close-knit. We're very, you know, family-orientated group. You know, I love to see them, to see their kids, to see that growing, to see the way that they're growing up, to see how things have changed from being, you know, 18 and now you're 28, and how life has changed, and that part of it. And I'd like, you know, the actual going to the stadium and watching them play and, you know, feeling that excitement, getting that enthusiasm. It's just not the same when you can't travel. Mm.
All right, last question from me. You've been doing this now for, I don't want to age you and age me, but you've been doing this now for what, more than 20 years now. What has surprised you most about how the game has changed and how the business has changed in these 20 years? And also, how does one get started? If somebody wants to say, I want to get in that line of work, where do you begin?
Well, I think what is important is, you know, and thanks for the 20 years.
Oh, that's bad. I'm much younger than you, so I'm not sure what you're talking about.
See that? I look good for 30, right? I started when I was 10. So, you know, I think that the business has diversified. We have grown a lot and we now understand a lot more about training techniques. We understand a lot more about how to treat medical issues. These things keep on developing and developing and developing. The one most important thing that I think has come out of it is that you'll see a lot more younger players coming through in bigger teams, whereby, you know, previously, as you remember, when I was in South America, that used to be the place where all the young players used to sort of, you know, evolve, and then they would mature and then they would come to Europe. Now they're coming much earlier. They're coming at 17, 18, the moment they can. You know, for example, João Pedro at Watford is a good example. He's not one of our players, but it's a good example of him coming through, or Richarlison when he came to, you know, Watford, and then went on to Everton. These players came in very, very young, much younger ages. And I think overall, the education level of how, you know, the players are brought about, you know, now we have the racism part that, you know, I think we're trying to do our best in terms of educating people about racism and the effects of racism. And a lot of that has evolved over the last 20 years. And I think that that is something that we are going in the right direction. Medicine is the biggest part of it. So if you have an injury or you have a, you know, a muscular issue, we've developed a much faster recuperation period than ever before. And that's because, you know, new techniques come out of, you know, doing microsurgeries and getting the muscle back into, you know, how we do the resting, how the muscle can be either massaged or the physio can do the work in terms of how they manage the recuperation period. You know, we get hamstrings that used to be 9 weeks, 10 weeks, which are now 6 weeks. So you've managed to shorten the length of time of those injuries.
All right. The second part of my question was, I don't know if you evaded it on purpose, but there's a 16-year-old kid watching and says, you know, when I grow up, I'm not good enough to be a footballer professionally, but I want to do what Kia does. What would you tell them? How does one get into your line of business? What is a good place to start? What do you need?
You know, growing up, I went through different types of businesses. I, you know, investment banking, and, you know, eventually I got into football. And I think the most important thing, first and foremost, is, you know, you really have to love what you do, because a lot of people have the wrong perception that, oh, I want to be an agent, or I want to be, you know, a CEO or a football director, because it's very easy to pick players. Well, it's, you know, that is not, you know, it's really not what it entitles, right? It's a lot of work. So, you know, a regular day for us starts around, you know, 8 a.m. and finishes about, you know, 10 p.m., 9 p.m. Easily. And then after that, we start to watch, you know, games across the globes and other countries. So sometimes, you know, I'll finish at 3 a.m. having watched my last, you know, MLS game, or you know, speaking to China, because you're doing global stuff. And you have to, if you want to get involved in this, it's because you don't think that this is an easy access or an easy route for you to you know, make a good living. I think it's more about, you really have to be passionate about the sport. You have to be passionate about the people in the sport. You have to be passionate about how things are operating, and then find, you know, a company that will mentor you, and you can start right at the bottom where, you know, we all did, and then slowly grow into that, have a better understanding of what it really takes and what football really means. Because everyone wants the glamorous side of it, but unfortunately, when the door's shut and the stadium is closed, you know, the glamour soon turns into, you know, hard work. And that's something that, you know, for everybody that wants to get into this, shouldn't think that this is an easy way to get through.
Kia, just finally for me, I promise you, you look after some of the biggest players in the world. Someone like David Luiz is having a very positive season, for example, at Arsenal. Someone like Philippe Coutinho is more difficult because he had a bad injury at the key time of the season. You know, without giving us too many secrets or anything, but could you tell us maybe a little bit, what do you think the future holds for them too, for example, or for others that you look after?
I think Coutinho has been injured for most of the season, and that's a perfect example of what I mean about the COVID, you know, situation having created that lull. Because, you know, we would like to have been there and make some decisions. And, you know, we've spent, although we've tried to do it on a Zoom and, you know, getting the right valuations, he'll be back soon. And so we're very hopeful with that. And he's, you know, he's making a full recovery, but it's taken him longer than I think it would have had we not been in a COVID situation. Mm-hmm. I think that would have just taken, you know, bang, 2 months, he would have been back in. His injury is not serious, but it's niggling. And I think that, you know, it's two different situations. If you have a very serious injury, you can understand that and it takes a while. If you have a niggling injury, it's just a way that you are proceeding with that. And I think, you know, with someone like David this year, you know, and throughout his career, you know, year in, year out, you know, he surprises everybody. You know, he will often get criticized for having that bad game, and then suddenly, you know, there's 30 games where everyone goes, okay, hang on a minute, this guy still, you know, got it. I think, you know, one pundit wrote him off about a year ago saying, you know, he's never going to play in the Premier League again, and yet, you know, he's been, you know, Arsenal's most consistent defender throughout the entire year. So, you know, I'm lucky because the boys that are in our group are dedicated. They know how to take care of their bodies. They are really, you know, amongst the nicest and best group of people anyone could wish for. So we are lucky to be in that position.
Kia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You've been very generous with your time, and best of luck.
Thanks, guys.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify is your no excuses business partner. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/gabjules, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/gabjules now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/gabjules. Enough, Kia. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gab.
Let's start with the defending champions. Antoine Griezmann scores a tidy goal, but France are held 1-1 by Ukraine. Jules, starting to get a little worried.
So people need to know, this is what we do. We start qualifiers for World Cup especially really badly all the time. I think we've won one in the last six first World Cup qualifier games. So this is not new. I don't know why, can't explain it, but even Deschamps' generation himself always struggle at the start of World Cup qualifiers. Worried I'm not, disappointed yes, because it was the first half was decent, and if VAR had been there, because even if UEFA...
Oh, it was a penalty.
Well, it was a penalty, but it was Griezmann's goal, as good as it was. Pavard was offside at the start of the move, so VAR or Pavard, but in this case, Pavard, because VAR wasn't there, but...
get it?
Pavard.
Oh, brilliant.
Hey. But the second half was terrible. I don't know, they fell asleep completely. There was no intensity, no rhythm, no creativity. Kylian Mbappe was dreadful. And Andrei Shevchenko, the Ukraine head coach after the game, said, we had a plan against Mbappe. We put more players on his side of the pitch to really sort of mark him closely and everything. So, not a good day.
Sophisticated stuff. Though.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. I
could go more into details, but listen.
We could give some credit to Shev, right? He got a point against world champions.
Exactly.
That's good.
Exactly. Belgium go a goal down against Wales at home, but some Kevin De Bruyne magic sent them on their way to a 3-1 win. Gab, it was pretty much as we expected, right?
Well, I didn't expect. Wales' opening goal was really, really
amazing,
good. Caught them flat-footed. Harry Wilson. It was funny, too. Like, Thomas Vermaelen started, and then Jason Denier came on, and I'm like, oh, I know what Martinez is doing, in addition to obviously rotating players because they're insanely playing 3 and 8 games. But Vermaelen's 35. He's been a part of Belgium. He's a Belgium legend.
Yeah.
He plays in Japan now,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
I think the plan is, all right, let's make sure people see enough of Thomas Vermaelen so that either Vermaelen understands that maybe it's okay to be on the bench or maybe, you know, I have enough reason to. But no, I thought they looked good, and there's a reason why they're favorites or among the favorites for the Euros.
Yeah, there was some positive stuff from Wales in the second half as well. They played high up on the pitch, they pressed well, they created chances. So even with a defeat, it's not all too bad for Wales.
Yeah, you got to put the Welsh
foot
forward. Of course. Sticking with Wales, yes, more Wales, Jules.
Yeah.
Gareth Bale announced before the game that it would return to Real Madrid at the end of the season because that was always the plan. He said he came to London to play first and foremost, but also to get fit for the Euros. I bet that wasn't Real Madrid's plan, was it?
But they knew it was a one loan deal, right? They knew after the season he would come back.
Yeah, and they knew that they were hoping that he'd come here and he'd be so happy and so productive that, like, I'm writing about this, right? So, but I've got a column coming up in the next few days. But Real Madrid's plan, their hope was, okay, look, you make an insane amount of money that we have to pay you 2021-22 season. You come to Spurs, you're a rip-roaring success.
Yeah.
It's close to Wales. You say, you know what? I want to stay here. And you reach a deal with Spurs, maybe like a 3-year deal or whatever.
But that can happen. That might still happen.
Well, which is precisely my point. This is something he said purely for leverage.
Yeah, probably. No, I agree with you. But I don't know why people are surprised and people are like criticizing him and saying like, oh, look, he uses Spurs as a, you know, as a training ground.
That's
and this
stupid.
And that.
This That's is so stupid.
It's not. This is a 1-year loan because he knew he would not play with Zidane in Madrid. So he goes to Spurs, plays more, he's fit, goes to the Euros with Wales, and then he will go back to Madrid. And then they see Zidane might not be the manager, and who comes next might want him to stay anyway, for all we know. He might.
I don't think that's very likely, but
no,
yeah.
But you don't know. They might finish the contract and both be happy with that, and then he can move somewhere. There's plenty of options.
And I think it's important just, you know, from a leverage perspective, to lay down the marker. You have no idea if Spurs are going to finish in the top four. If Spurs don't finish in the top four, Spurs are paying, depending who you talk to, either a third to a half of his wages. Spurs aren't going to want to pay that if they're in the Europa League.
Definitely not.
They may not want to pay it anyway if Mourinho doesn't like him anymore.
Yeah.
So, or who knows if Mourinho's even still there.
Yeah.
But you lay down a marker saying, hey, I'll come back to Madrid, play some golf, and take my chances. So you be prepared.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Burak Yılmaz scores a hat-trick and Turkey beat Holland 4-2. Gab is 35 years old, moved to Ligue 1 in Lille in the summer. He's taken them top of the table. He's been amazing until his recent injury. Please, help me celebrate the big man because he was outstanding against the Netherlands.
I, I love this story because this is a guy who, I'm pretty sure he played his entire career in Turkey. You know, played for Beşiktaş, played for Galatasaray years ago. You know, had some tremendous years. Great player. Great players aren't just in the big five leagues, in the League of Talents, as you like to call yourselves. And he does this, a hat-trick against Holland at 35 years of age. What a story. Now, apart from Davy Klaassen's absurdly good turn and finish, there wasn't much to celebrate for the Dutch. Jules, something tells me you're going to blame Frank de Boer since you're now being nice to Ronald Koeman.
Listen, this is how we can sum up what Frank de Boer has done with Holland. Seven games, right? Two wins. It's like he's driving a Ferrari. The problem is he doesn't have his driving license. He's got no idea what to do. Ronald Koeman had built something interesting there. There was an identity. There was a formation. There was some momentum going. And he's come in and just ruined it all completely, ripped it apart. What we saw was just vertical passes, slow, no rhythm.
Like this, it's horizontal nothing. Passes.
Horizontal passes, sorry, not vertical passes. This was dire. I mean, how bad were they?
But Jules, it's remarkable that given his stellar CV before taking the job, the immense positive impact he had in Cincinnati, at Crystal Palace, at Inter, I mean, it's pretty shocking that...
It's terrible. I mean, you meant Atlanta.
Being sarcastic. Not Atlanta, Cincinnati.
Yeah, but it was... It's unbelievable he got that kind of job. And now I feel for the players, and I hope he turns it around or someone else comes in and turns it around. But this was one of the worst. Cristiano Ronaldo was hoping to add to his 102 international goals tally to close in on Ali Daei's record of 109, Gab. Didn't really quite work out for him and Portugal against Azerbaijan, although they won, of course.
But. Yeah, Cristiano was playing at home, too, in Turin. I still think they have to figure out how these pieces fit together, Cristiano and Andre Silva. They had chances, but Azerbaijan had everybody back. Azerbaijan has an Italian manager. Of course, Gianni De Biasi, former Albania manager, who loves nothing more than disrupting storybook moments. But hey, Portugal got the 3 points and an own goal, and onwards and upwards.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Many had figured Norway's trip to Gibraltar would be a great opportunity for Erling Haaland to pad out his international goal numbers. Jules, Gibraltar did quite well. They kept a clean sheet until nearly the end of the first half.
Exactly. Their goalkeeper, who's also Glenn Torren's goalkeeper, did really well defensively.
Glenn Torren's world-famous goalkeeper.
I'm just saying, that's his club.
Well done.
Yeah, well done to him. Well done to them. They defended well. Eventually, Norway were too good. Maybe surprising that Erling Haaland, who played just over an hour, didn't score. But hey, he will have other opportunities. And before the game, Gab, by the way, Norway wore T-shirts calling for human rights on and off the pitch, which is a reference to Qatar 2022, right?
Yeah, it is. Not an explicit reference, because I think that would have been weird, because it's like you're trying to qualify for a World Cup, but then you're kind of criticized, you know.
Yeah.
But there have been clubs who've called for a boycott. Look, I think human rights... You can never talk enough about it.
Yeah.
And that's what the players are doing. I think it's a positive message. Qatar 2022, the organizers have said, we've already made a lot of changes. We've improved things. It takes time. We're going to continue improving. Let's hold everybody to account.
Yeah, exactly.
After 9 years, Nicky Butt has quit Manchester United, where he was head of first team development, to, quote, seek a new challenge. Jules, are you surprised? Is it weirdly coincidental that this happens after Darren Fletcher and John Murtagh get appointed to senior roles?
Not surprised, because clearly the combo of Murtagh and Fletcher was not to Nicky Butt's taste. So, hey, you know, he can always...
I don't know if it was that or if it was not to his taste,
well,
but
it does feel like...
But you know what? I've had to work with him in the past, like... He's a bright guy.
I think he
can do things somewhere.
Definitely. Former FIFA president Sepp Blatter has been banned again by FIFA Ethics Committee for another 6 years and fined nearly $1 million. Gab, his current ban was going to expire in October, and he's not happy with the new six-year one.
Yeah, he went so far as to say that FIFA's ethics committee is just an extension of Gianni Infantino. There's a whole back and forth thing going on with the courts and stuff like that. People having a go at the current FIFA administration, mostly people from the disgraced, I have to say. I think we can legitimately say former administration. I think if you want to be really cynical, you can say, well, they made sure they extended his ban because in October, theoretically, he could have run again. And he's still popular in some quarters, even though he's 85 years old. Yeah. Jérôme Valcq, by the way, your countryman.
Both give themselves like 30 million euros bonuses at some point?
Over the years, they earned an enormous amount of bonuses, too. Look, I think the sooner we don't hear from this man again, I think the better.
Yeah.
According to Catalan media, Ronald Koeman is pitching to stay another year and has submitted his plan. He wants Messi to stay, wants the club to sign Eric Garcia, Gini Wijnaldum, and Memphis Depay. Jules, this sounds an awful lot like what the big plan was last summer.
Exactly, Gab. Exactly the players that he wanted last summer as well. Eric Garcia, I understand, and coming back to Barcelona as well. Wijnaldum and Depay.
Wijnaldum is free, Depay.
Yeah, Depay is free as well. But the way they're playing right now, I'm not really sure exactly where they fit. But hey, they need more budget.
But look, the Messi extending is a good idea.
That's a good idea. I wonder who else would have had
that. I'm going to lift a little lid here. If I were writing a story, what do you think Koeman would do if he sticks around? Oh, gee, what do we know? Oh, we'll go back and sign the same guys he wanted a year ago. I mean, come on.
Yeah. UEFA will discuss the future of financial fair play on Friday. Gab, which way is this going?
So in the immediate, obviously, financial fair play has been suspended. Different people are suggesting different things. We heard from Kia earlier his thoughts. I think what's critical is that I disagree a little bit. I think without financial fair play, I think this whole system might well have collapsed due to COVID. So I think oversight has to be there. Hopefully more transparency. But equally, the mechanism has to be there to make it easier for mid-sized clubs to invest and move up. Mm. And you know, a closed shop was excessive. Now it's time to loosen the shackles a little bit.
Yeah.
And look for growth. The Czech Republic beat Estonia 6-2, but Jules, help me celebrate Tomáš Souček.
Yeah.
He scored a hat trick. He can't be stopped.
Incredible. I think he scored 24 goals in the last 2 years, and none of them is penalties. Incredible player. You cannot not like him.
He's a big Mr. Bump.
Yeah. Germany's boss, Jogi Löw, says that he will decide in May whether Thomas Müller and Mats Hummels, who are not anymore with Germany, should be brought back into the national team for the Euros. Gab, does this make sense to you? And why not bringing them now if you had planned to bring them for the Euros?
You bring them now to help you decide. I don't know. These two guys were seen as part of his rebuilding. The weird thing is now he doesn't have to rebuild anything because he's gone after the Euros. Personally, I think Thomas Müller could definitely help.
Definitely.
Hummels, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
Scary moments for Moussa Dembélé, who fainted in training with Atletico Madrid on Tuesday. Jules?
He's all fine, Gab. He fainted, as you said, a bit of dizziness at training. We saw him, he was stretching, and then suddenly he went back, which is scary footage to see, but he's all good now. He's back home in good spirit. They will keep checking on him, but all good. Ralf Rangnick has reportedly signed returned to Schalke, who were looking for him to their rebuild. That's wise, right?
Absolutely. No money, they're going to go down. Not worth it. Milan keeper Gigio Donnarumma is out of contract in the summer, and talks have started. Gazzetta dello Sport says there are three potential replacements: Atalanta's Pierluigi Gollini, Udinese's Juan Musso, and Lille's Mike Maignan. Who do you like best out of three?
Mike Maignan every time, but I still think Donnarumma is going to stay anyway. Christian Pulisic and Mohamed Salah are both under pressure back home to play in the Olympic Games over the summer. Gab, what do you think about that?
This is always really tricky, because viewed from a European perspective, we're like, what is this football at the Olympics? What is this nonsense? I mean, where we live in England, of course, for a long time, we didn't have a team at the Olympics because that weird thing where they're one country,
GB,
whatever nonsense that is. Look, this is important for them. I understand the club's positions. Hopefully they can reach an amicable solution. But let's not forget, for countries like Egypt and the U.S., this is a chance to win a global tournament.
Big,
this is really, really big. Yeah. So I hope clubs can be a little bit understanding. It's going to be over in August. Not as big a deal as it would be otherwise.
Yeah.
The European Under-21 tournament kicked off this week. It's a bit weird because of COVID. They're going to play the group stages now, three games in 8 days.
Yeah.
Then they're all going to go back to their teams. They're going to come back and they're going to squeeze in the quarterfinals.
So the ones who qualified,
The ones who qualified, they're going to squeeze it in before the big boy Euros start. Tor Christian Carlsen gave us his list of players to watch. Yeah. Who are yours? And no, you cannot say Camavinga because that's too obvious.
French are loaded. French are loaded with talent. And on top of that, Moussa Diaby had COVID, so he had to forfeit. Same with Ousmane Awar.
So he's not there. So tell us about the guys
who are
there.
Saying to you who you could have seen, Awar and Diaby as well. But I will just give you, I mean, Guiri, who's doing fantastically well with Nice in Ligue 1.
He's one of Tours' picks.
Yeah. And obviously, Jules Koundé. And
you don't just have to mention French players.
No, no, I'm just... No, I start with France, please. Okay. Then if you look at Holland, you've got someone like Boadu, who's doing so well with AZ Alkmaar. Justin Kluivert is in the front three with Noah Lang as well, who's doing much better now in Belgium than he was doing at Ajax. If you look at Italy, Scamacca scored, the Genoa striker scored on Wednesday, where Sandro Tonali was sent off, by the way. Not really good start for them.
Not a good season for him.
Germany don't have, apart from obviously Moukoko, but the rest of that generation is maybe not as good.
I think Moukoko's enough.
Yeah, he's enough. Spain have seven players from La Masia who at least have been at La Masia into the 23-man squad, which is very much a return of those players from Barcelona into the team, like Cucurella and Ricky Puig is in there. So you've got a few there. Well, Romania were pretty good.
It's a fun watch. This is always really, a really,
Portugal
really good
have
tournament.
A really, really good generation coming through as well with Trincao, for example. Trincao is there for Portugal. So listen, you should watch it because it's going to be very good. Alfonso Davies has been appointed Goodwill Ambassador for the United Nations Refugee Agency. Gab, how meaningful is this?
So I was in two minds about this. I mean, he is the first, he's the first footballer to be named there. Yes. I think these kind of roles, if they're just ceremonial and you're just kind of going through the motions, then it's pretty meaningless. But this guy's been really passionate about it because obviously
it's his own story. Yeah.
It's his own story. He's seen it around it. He's been speaking about this for years, since way before he became a UN Goodwill Ambassador. And I'll tell you what, if I have to name somebody to it, this is exactly what
Perfect,
I want. Because
yeah.
He's articulate, he's bright, he's popular, he's a very good footballer when he's not getting sent off after 12 minutes. I'm sorry, Alfonso. But no, this is exactly who you want.
Yeah.
He's a tremendous spokesman for a really, really important cause.
Yeah.
ESPN's women's ranking, where they rank the top 50 women footballers, is out. The top three are, in reverse order, Viviane Miedema, Sam Kerr, and Sam Mewis. Jules, I don't get to follow women's football in non-Women's World Cup years, so I'm going to rely on you. Is this correct, Frank?
Yeah, I think this is correct. You could always argue between Sam Mewis and Sam Kerr. Kerr is having a wonderful season with Chelsea. Well, since she's joined Chelsea, really, she's been fantastic. Chelsea probably being the best team right now in the world. I'm there. I think it's great that ESPN are doing this. It's fantastic. You know, go and check it out on the website. There's some names that you know, of course. Some of the Americans, of course, like Megan Rapinoe and people like that have been on the scene for a long time, that are very popular. But there's all the other names that you might not know that you will discover going through the article. And then you can check the Champions League, the Women's Champions League quarterfinals. The first leg was on Wednesday. You'll have second leg coming next week. It's really high level, great football.
I think one of the keys in the way this is put together is they actually picked people who cover women's football intently.
Yeah.
Week in, week out, who sit there and stream all the games. You know, not people who are going to vote based on who's famous. So Alex Morgan is in the list, but I think she's like in
lower
the high 30s or whatever, because it is based on the last 12 months. Megan Rapinoe as well. She's not number one.
No.
Like, you know, some people would give her the Ballon d'Or every year. But no, if you don't play, you know, and there are people who look at this very, very seriously. So if you're a fan of women's football, I think hopefully you'll appreciate this more than,
check it out.
You know, those other lists where you say, oh, let's put the big names in there just for the hell of it.
And talking about Megan Rapinoe, she gave testimony to the U.S. House Oversight Committee on the importance of equal pay and inequality. Gab, will this have much of an impact? We know of the fight between, obviously, the U.S. Federation and then the women's team especially.
I mean, it'll have an impact, again, on public opinion. I think that message is out there. But, you know, it's not the U.S. House Oversight Committee that decides how much women who play for the national team should get paid.
Yeah.
I think it's an important issue. I think it's an issue, though, that really varies country to country. Because in some countries, the women's team generates enormous amounts of money.
Yeah.
In others, they don't. And then you get into an issue of, okay, with the amount of money that is generated, am I best off paying the women who play for the national team, who, in the case of the U.S., you know, most of these are professional women, some of the best in the world, and they do generate a lot of money. In other places, it's going to be expanding the base. I think the overarching priority in addition to equal pay, has to be to make the game more accessible so that women who want to play football can play football. Not necessarily have to be professional. In some cases, maybe it's better if it's semi-professional. But that they can do it without worrying about, you know, time off for maternity, without worrying about work getting in the way if they have day jobs, that it becomes accessible. Because I'll tell you what, I was shocked by this, but 1 in 4 FIFA member nations don't have a women's national team, for example.
Yeah.
And so that has to be critical, that somebody, that women have the same opportunities to play as men. And in most of the world, that's really not the case. Neymar has signed a new partnership with Fortnite. Jules, it may surprise you to find out that I'm no gamer, so I have no idea. Is this meaningful, or is Fortnite actually a little bit 2018?
No, it's not. There's still millions of people
A little bit like Neymar. They're both
You're so mean.
Big guy.
Listen, I think they're trying to diversify a bit in terms of the high-profile people who play, and you will be able to play with Neymar's character in
you
the game.
You can get Neymar skin.
Yeah, if you want, and stuff like that, which I think is pretty cool. He plays a lot. And I think
he's had more time playing during his injury, of course.
Of course, but before that, I think he was giving them enough publicity without that partnership. So I guess this works for everyone. And I'm curious to see the next time you play Fortnite, if you take Neymar's character or not.
Do they have a Materazzi one?
Not yet. But maybe that's the next one, you know. Former Italy coach Cesare Prandelli has resigned as manager of Fiorentina, Gab, this week, citing a dark shadow inside him and basically that he didn't recognize himself into this current football world. What does this mean, and how big could this be, and how brave from him?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think he's going to come out and he's going to talk about this. He's been pretty open with people around him. I know what it is. He'll say what it is when he's ready, but it is a mental health. It is a mental
health
issue.
Felt like this, yeah.
I don't think the way his the way his statement was written was helpful, because it left you wondering, you know, oh my God, what is it? You know, is it some sort of terminal illness? It's not. Is it some a rejection of modern football and its values? No, it's not. But look, this is a guy who I think a lot of people really, really like, because, you know, when he was Italy manager, he famously introduced a code of ethics. He took a very strong stand against homophobia, very strong stand on racism, backed it up by dropping players who even made certain inappropriate cracks, especially when it comes to homophobia, like Cassano. So, he's seen as one of the good guys, and he's 64, and I think, I knowing him a little bit, he's going to turn the story into a positive, in the sense, share his experience so that other people faced the situation, you know, can feel, can get support if they need it. Right, that brings us to an end today, but Jules, we got more international football, so should we come back on Monday?
Let's come back on Monday.
Sounds good, man. Until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.